The Honourable the Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, if I may, I've been busy over lunch. There were a couple of questions in relation to the schedules on education, which I think I've been able to clear up. The first one, if I may, was one PGCE, which is clearly treated as non-mandatory. I'm going to give generalities because the voter being the president and the society that we are, if I give too many details of the subject, colleges and so on, people are going to know which student we may be referring to. So, in general terms, this was a person who had already completed a degree course and a postgraduate course on a completely different subject, was already in employment, and applied for a PGC in a completely different subject. So they didn't tick all the boxes, so it had to be treated as discretionary, and the board did not feel that they could award it at the time. It wasn't a run-of-the-mill one. In relation to the law ones, which were non-mandatory, they were, in effect, either conversion or similar requests for postgraduate work well after they had finished their first degree, so they become discretionary. And finally, Mr. Speaker, let's go in relation to 603 and the study there too. In relation to question 612, where the devoted college is missing in some of the pages, this has now been amended and the revised study is being distributed now, and my apologies for that oversight of the pages that left out in one of the stages of dealing with the table in the computer.
Just in relation to the law ones, I've noticed from the schedule that the Honourable Gentleman has provided that prior to 2016, the law ones were, and indeed some of them referred to the diploma, so it's obvious that it's a conversion course. Those conversion courses were discretionary, then afterwards they are mandatory. As from about 2015. Is the Honourable Gentleman aware of the policy change in relation to this?
No, Mr. Speaker, I'm not. I was not Minister at that time, so if there was a policy change, as there could have been, I was not responsible for that in the department. But I can inquire, and obviously not for today's session, but I can provide the Honourable Member information outside the House if he's happy with that, if not, I'd be happy to answer it on another occasion here.
We now move to question 615, the Honourable Ms. M.B. Hassanan.
Does government have any updates in connection with its commitment from April of this year to look into banning smoking and tobacco?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, no, sir.
Mr. Speaker, can I ask why the return into a public statement that was made into reviewing the legislation that has now stopped being under review?
No, there's no further development. I know from my honourable friend that the DSLA doesn't normally allow it anyway, although it's not legislated. We were looking, we just haven't progressed, there hasn't been a decision not to do so. We were looking, I think I had some correspondence to the Honourable Lady as to some of the areas that she didn't feel. I think Commonwealth Park, you mentioned, the Honourable Lady mentioned to me, and I think that the Honourable Lady tried to clarify with me that she was talking about the children's playground. Enclosed, yes. So, it's not that it isn't happening or there's been a policy decision, just that it hasn't been progressed, but it's something that is certainly on our to-do list and we will be taking it up further.
Question number 616, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassanan.
would government consider the paying an on-call allowance to people on the supply list?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education. Speaker, I apologise for this being really short in both my answers to the Honourable Lady, but the answer is also good, no sir.
Mr. Speaker, my question is based around the concern for these supply teachers in the sense that they cannot apply for other jobs and they also cannot apply for unemployment benefits while at the same time they're being stuck every morning at the end of the telephone line. And from what I understand, other government agencies do pay some type of on-call allowance fee in certain departments. So perhaps I was just trying to inquire if this could be equalized or normalized.
Mr. Speaker, I think the Honourable Lady is not correct in what you're saying. On-call allowances are paid to staff and the employee of the government when they have to be available for call-outs. Supply staff, can you call the supply staff, are not actually directly in the employee. They're available to be called in. And I don't believe there are any supply staff within the whole of the public service or associated to the whole of the public service who have an on-call fee just in case they're called in to work. It's a different arrangement to an on-call allowance proper, which is provided for in the public service. It's not the same.
Question number 617, the Honourable
Mr. Speaker. Can we go and confirm the number of persons registered as unemployed?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation.
Would the government, Mr. Speaker, we will be proceeding with the questions to the Honourable Minister of Finance.
We move to question 621. The Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the does the government intend to introduce a technology-based apprenticeship, and how does it envisage this working?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Speaker, as the Honourable Member is aware, the policy of the government is to provide training for employment. The Member is also aware that my department has written to all employers with 5 employees or more to ascertain whether they are interested in providing work-based placement for apprentices, and therefore any new apprenticeship that might be provided in future will depend on the result of establishing a demand for the skills in the private sector.
I didn't recall hearing answers regarding the people registered as unemployed.
I was not answering the question. I was answering the other way.
Question number 622, the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, can the government please advise how taking liquid withdrawals or industrial sales should in detail of all bank savings, bank accounts, and cash held for the following date, being 1st of August 2017?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Speaker, we'll answer the question together with 623, 624, and 625.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise the balance on the general sinking fund as at the 1st of August 2017?
624, the Honourable Iron
Clinton. Mr. Speaker, can the government advise the total liquid reserve figure
and specifically, mainly consolidated funds, improvements in development funds, government-owned companies, deposits, contingencies, and other funds, for the following date being the 1st of August 2017.
Question number 625, the Honourable Iron Pinson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please provide the total gross debt aggregate debt off application of the sinking fund to a gross debt, capital reserve and net debt figures for public debt for the following date being the 1st of August 2017?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Speaker, the position of the debt of total liquid asset composition, when, where, and how these are invested on a particular day chosen by the member opposite, continues to be as previously stated. The figures requested for the 1st of August 2017 are gross debt $447.7 million, general sinking fund $5.2 million, aggregate debt $442.5 million, cash $106.8 million, net debt $335.7 million.
I'm grateful to the Minister for his answer. I think he's been missing the unemployed numbers.
If I must have explained to the Honourable Member that I am not supposed to be giving him the unemployed numbers. Remember, the question was posed when the Minister responsible for employment was not here. But I would happily have given it to him if I knew.
Stephen, I guess that question is still pending. I apologize to the Minister.
I think we have a short 10-minute difference. Yeah, that's one of the things that we can do. Thank you. Question number 626, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government say how many children are currently in care and or the subject of a care order?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, there are 36 children in care, of which 25 are subject of care orders.
Question number 627, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state the numbers of agency workers currently working within our care and health services by reference to each company that provides workers?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the number of agency workers currently working within our care and health services is as follows. ABBA, 110. Grand Home Care 142, Jude Care 1, SNK 36, Better Service 12, JFM 18, Medoc 42, Athena 1, Ted Medical 1, National Locums 2. Mr. Speaker, I wonder whether the Minister can help me with a supplementary question in relation to the impact of the agency workers regulation of 2012 in respect of those workers of that total amount that the Minister has referred to the various companies, how many have worked over the requisite 52 weeks under those regulations? Mr. Speaker, will you notice of that question? Well, I'll ask it in the next question.
Mr. Speaker, just so that I understand the government's view of things, and perhaps you can answer this question. The government's policy is that their interpretation of the relevant provisions is that if a worker is employed by a recruitment agency, he's therefore not employed by the government. But therefore, the regulations that provide that if you serve a period of time effectively, you should then be engaged on a permanent basis. But those don't apply to the workers of recruitment consultants or agencies.
Mr. Speaker, that, as I understand it, is right that whenever someone may want to go back in his recollection to a time before the last general election, when we had a number of discussions around the subject. I'm unable to cite the authority right now, but there is a European authority that provides such workers, agency workers, with the right to apply for internal vacancies in the places of work where they have been posted by those agencies, if they've been there for a particular period of time. I think that period of time, I think, is a year. So once you're in an agency and you are placed in a particular period, although the 4-year period may not be relevant to you, because in those 4 years, you may be working for that agency in different places, or you may be working for the agency for 4 years, you may not be placed in the same place for that period. If the agency places you in a place of work and you experience a period of more than 1 year in that same place of work, you're then entitled by the operation of this European policy to be dealt with as an internal applicant for vacancy in that organisation. And I think that's the benefit that many who have been placed with employment agencies in the public sector places of employment have the benefit of in the candidates that we've been at. Speaker, just one follow-up question in relation to it. I'm grateful for the Chief intervention in relation to the right to apply for a vacancy. And as far as my previous question as to the right of an individual concerned to enjoy the same rights as those permanent employees of the relevant organisations, such as the health authority, for example. So
with the agency workers enjoy the same rights, i.e. rights in wage, holiday leave, entitlements, that they rest of it. Then the speaker being agency employee will be bound by whatever contract is signed with the agency. But whatever law they are sanctioned, of course, the agency can't vacate the rights afforded to any party by statute. So anything that's in the law, they'll have to be carried with. But agency employees are regulated by whatever contract they enter into with the agency company.
Question number 628, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Does the government have any plans to amend existing provisions in our law in relation to rehabilitation of offenders?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 629, 630 and 659.
Question number 629, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the Minister confirm whether the government has any plans to move towards an electronic filing system for issues of claims and applications for the Gibraltar Court Service?
Question number 630, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government say how many complaints relating directly to such offences have been made by citizens to the RGP, and of those, how many resulted in charges being brought?
Question number 659, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan.
In accordance with this government's manifesto promise, where it committed to increase manning levels in HM prison with the numbers recommended by the Joint Working Group, has it decided yet how many officers they are going to employ and by when?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, there are no current plans to amend existing provisions in the law in relation to the rehabilitation of offenders. This, however, is an area of the law which is kept under review and one which, in particular, may be informed by the examination of local sentencing laws by the Law Commission. Mr. Speaker, the government currently does not have any plans to move toward an electronic filing system for issues of claims and applications in the Supreme Court. However, as part of the e-government strategy and in full consultation with the Honourable Minister for Commerce, as a feature, we are looking at the possibility of integrating such a system at some point should it prove to be financially feasible. Mr. Speaker, in relation to the question 2030, the question does not specify the date for which the information is requested. However, since April of this year, to date, the RGP has received 27 complaints, of which 3 have resulted in charges being brought. Mr. Speaker, in respect of R31-2759, government should be in a position to make an announcement in respect of patron prison staffing levels within the first quarter of next year. Mr. Speaker, in relation to question 628, I'm sure that the Minister would agree that there are certain barriers to employment and barriers to opportunity and access to these opportunities by those who have been convicted of criminal offences and have served a period of imprisonment. And what they did in the United Kingdom was to lower the period that we have in our jurisdiction to encourage more employers to take on those that have been unfortunately dealt with in that way as far as the custodial sentence is concerned. And those changes happened in 2012 because I think the experience in that jurisdiction was that it did create significant barriers to employment and opportunity. Is it right in saying that the Minister does anticipate that there will be a review of this process with the Law Commission? Well, Mr. Speaker, the older gentleman referred me to the thing that he said in 2012. The Honourable former Minister for Justice, Mr. McCreevy, came to the House in 2014 in order to make the rehabilitation of offender provisions more available in the UK. So our provisions currently, yes, it happened in 2014. So our provisions currently will be set in the UK. Maybe then the government is going to additional amendments in the UK, of which I am not familiar. And I agree with him that the reason why the Honourable Minister, the former Minister for Justice,
I think it's to whoever the initial position, the practice of the region that relates to. And we need to make sure that the period of rehabilitation is sufficient for the person to become rehabilitated, but also quick enough so that the person can reintegrate and step into society and realize his qualifications and get a copy of rights to. The most important condition for any person to be able to reintegrate into society is being able to gain some income.
In effect, I think the Minister has definitely held the position wrong, but I'm quite happy to have a discussion with him about those rehabilitation periods. So I understand that obviously the law changed in 2014, but they do not reflect the position that was happening in the United Kingdom regarding the problem. I'm quite happy to have a discussion separately offline with him, as it were.
Mr. Speaker, can I just ask the Minister whether with this new batch, the number that he will confirm, as he said, on the first quarter of next year, will any number of this new complement be the same individuals who would eventually be a part of the new Young Offenders Facility Centre, or would it be, would that be a different batch of individuals?
Mr. Speaker, I think I referred to the other Mr. Phillips in the last question. The issue of secure accommodation for juveniles and the issue of a detention facility for juveniles arising the other than Mr. Young. But I'm not certain. I think it was the only Mr. Phillips. It's frankly actively being looked at by different officials of the care agencies, magistrate prison, and other relevant agencies. The options have been looked at as to whether possible to combine the two accommodation and the detention facilities. I note that in the UK it has been possible to combine both. And therefore, should there be combined juvenile secure accommodation facility and a detention centre, there will have to be an additional increase in resources, because currently the resources that exist do not cater for those facilities. And as the Honourable Lady and Gentleman will obviously realise, there has to be a bill or certainly additional regulations introduced, but most likely family legislation, because of course, secure accommodation, which will be entirely new, and in terms of the facilities, will also be entirely new.
Question number 631, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please explain the significant increase in expenditure and treatment of patients in foreign hospitals medical establishments from 3.6 million in 2012 to 15.4 million in 2016?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 632, 633, 640 to 647, 650, 653, 655, and 656.
Question number 632, the Honourable DAP.
Can the government please state what the expenditure and treatment of patients in foreign hospitals medical establishments has been so far in 2017?
Question number 632, the Honourable
DAP. Can the government please explain its policy for referrals to specialist clinics such as the Clinica Universidad de Navarra?
Question number 630, the Honourable Ian Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, who are the members of the GHA Tertiary Referral Board and what are their medical specialisms?
Question number 641, the Honourable Ian Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, what are the terms of reference of the GHA Tertiary Referral Board, and on what date was it established?
question number 642, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Speaker, who appoints members of the GHA Tertiary Referrals Board, and what is the term of appointment?
Question number 643, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, in the period from the 1st of January 2017 to the 30th of September 2017, how many times has the GHA Tertiary Referrals Board met, and on what date?
Question number 644, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, how many cases have been considered by the GHA Tertiary Referrals Board in the period from 1st of January 2017 to 30th September 2017, broken down by type of treatment or investigation, and of those, how many have not been approved and why in each case?
Question number 645, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, how many complaints have been made to the Ombudsman in respect of the decisions of the GHA Tertiary Referrals Board in the period 1st of January 2017 to the 30th of September 2017?
Question number 646, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, what is the appeals process in respect of the decisions of the GHA Tertiary Referrals Board?
Question number 647, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, what criteria is used by the GHA Tertiary Referrals Board in determining grounds for approval for treatment in another hospital?
Question number 650, the Honourable Ellis Lemon.
To the Speaker, can the government provide a schedule of payments made and invoices pending payments to each foreign health establishment in each financial year since April 2012 to date in relation to sponsor patients?
Question number 653, the Honourable Ellis Lemon.
Mr. Speaker, can the government explain how, since the implementation of the CHA Tertiary Board, several sponsored patients are being refused for continued care with partnership trust in the UK without prior consultation with a specialist consultant in the UK, and only just now the CHA has made initial contact with a consulting surgeon in the UK asking for their professional advice with a footnote of estimated cost to be forwarded for consideration?
Question number 655, the Honourable Ellis Lemons.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm how many consultations and referrals have been approved by the GHA Tertiary Board for specific amounts to being paid earlier this year, including A, the cost of each referral, B, the health establishment referral, C, the medical condition of the patient, and D, the date the patient considers?
Question number 656, the Honourable Ellis Lemons.
Can the government confirm how many consultation referrals have been refused by the GHA Tertiary Board, including A, the estimated cost of each referral, B, the health establishment referred to, and C, the medical condition of the patient?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, there has been a significant increase year on year, except for 2015. In the treatment expenditure establishments outside of the building. The reasons for this are a matter of toil and include the rapid advance of medical technology and availability of new treatments and procedures, the increase in the population in terms of healthcare, resident population plus country workers, the changing population demographic with a larger proportion of elderly members of our society. There are also non-clinical reasons, such as the decrease in the value of pounds versus euro that have caused fluctuation. I can assure the Honourable Gentleman in the House that improving the efficiency of the sponsored patients programme has been a top priority for government. Working closely with the Medical Director and sponsored patients departments and their officials, the GHA has introduced improvements on the existing databases which have resulted in the constitution of the Tertiary Referrals Board. Mr. Speaker, I refer for the current financial year up to the end of September is £4,426,462.25, and invoice spending of £1,017,402.40. This figure appears to provide care to a relatively small community, and this represents a unique set of challenges. We are able to deal with most common conditions, and our clinical teams provide as much breadth of service as possible. There are many such specialties and complex treatments that can be provided locally, and these treatments will need to be referred to specialist centres where the care of uncommon conditions is centralised. To ensure that standards are maintained, we will preferentially refer patients for care outside of the border to organisations with high clinical standards and robust clinical governance. Patients are usually referred to the NHS in the UK. We have special contract arrangements known as service level agreements, SLAs, with a number of UK NHS staff where we preferentially send our patients. These SLAs allow us to monitor the quality of care delivered and, where necessary, work with our organisations to deliver the standards of care that we expect. VHH patients also have access to non SLA NHS centres for super specialised treatment. These referrals will usually only be exceptionally approved when specific treatments are required that are not available in one of our SLA partner institutions. We also refer patients to health care institutions in Spain. These institutions are either Spanish state hospitals or private hospitals with which we have a service level agreement. As is in the case in the UK, VHH patients also have access to non SLA Spanish centres for super specialised treatment, and Clínica Universitaria de Navarra is one of such centres. The board is tasked with monitoring the VHH policy for specialty referrals. The current policy is as follows. All patients having treatment outside the GHK need to have a named GHK consultant in charge of the care. This named consultant should provide treatment and follow up locally if possible. While local expertise or necessary equipment is not available, the named consultant will refer the patients from the first instance to one of the visiting consultants if they have the necessary expertise. In cases where the necessary care cannot be provided by a visiting consultant, the named consultant will refer the patient to one of the contracted healthcare providers in the UK or in Spain. If the care required by the patient cannot be provided by one of the contracted healthcare partners, this will be sought in a non-contracted institution with the relevant expertise as determined by the board members in partnership with the named consultant. Wherever follow-up can be provided locally, there is no clinical need for patients to travel outside of Gibraltar. The figure the testing referral board, to our brief short, is composed of 17 clinicians and clinical directors whose specialties are varied. The names of the board members are confidential to ensure objectivity and prevent any lobbying from interested parties. Mr. Speaker, in respect of questions for 1041, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to the supplementary answers given to questions 524 to 526 of this year. The terms of reference for the testing referral board are as follows. The PRB ensures that all testing referrals are appropriate from the clinical perspective and in accordance with applicable DHH testing referral policy. The board considers all testing referrals by way of a peer review process. All testing referrals, except for emergency referrals, are approved by the PRB before patients are referred to the testing centre. The testing referrals board are convened and chaired by the medical director or his nominated delegate. The board members will be selected by the medical director and these are senior clinicians. It is envisaged that the composition of the board will change regularly and in accordance with clinical commitments of the board members. Decisions are made by majority vote. In the case of a split vote, the chairperson has a casting vote. The outcome of the referrals is communicated to the referring consultant and secretary by email today, and patients informed the next working day. The speaker of the board members are appointed by the medical director. The term of appointment is not fixed, as this is a new process for the GHK, and a period of assessment, review, and development is anticipated. Mr. Speaker, since the board was set up on the 4th of May, the TRB has met 20 times, as follows: 4th of May, 11th of May, 18th of May, 25th of May, 1st of June, 8th of June, 15th of June, 22nd of June, 29th of June, 6th of July, 20th of July, 27th of July, 10th of August, 17th of August, 24th of August, 21st of August, 7th of September, 14th of September, 21st of September, 28th of September. Mr. Speaker, since the 4th of May, the TRB has considered 550 cases, of which 466 were approved and 33 were not approved, as these did not meet the stipulated referral criteria. 51 were offered alternative care pathways, which resulted in either further local treatment or referral to another external centre. I also refer the Honourable Gentleman to the answer I provided to question 633 of this year, which refers to referral criteria. Mr. Speaker, I also refer the Honourable Gentleman to my budget speech, where I announced the efforts of my top GHA management team in repatriating as many services as possible to Gibraltar so that patients can be treated at home. This has been possible not only by the continuous endeavours of the team, but also at a reduced expenditure spend compared to the spend last year to date, without compromising in any way the quality of care provided. On the contrary, I am sure that the Honourable Gentleman would agree that receiving the same level of quality and professional treatment at home is in the best interest of our patients. I again remind the Honourable Gentleman on the unprecedented number of surgery interventions conducted at Inverness Hospital, with a staggering 161 major surgical procedures requiring inpatient stay conducted during the first 4 months of the year, nearly double the number performed in the same period last year. To date, a total of 340 major surgical procedures requiring inpatient stay have been conducted. I again reiterate, Mr. Speaker, that there have been no cancellations of surgical operations due to lack of beds since January of this year. Mr. Speaker, this achievement cannot be underestimated, not least given the answers that I used to receive in the House when I was the opposition spokesperson for health, where I was repeatedly told by the Honourable Lady, Mrs. Yvette Delagua, what will the government do to ensure that operations never have to be cancelled due to bed shortages? Answer, nothing. There is nothing that the government can do to ensure that no operation will ever have to be cancelled because of bed shortage. Not in the GHA, not in the UK, not in the Nurses' State Centre, and not in the Houston Medical Centre, nowhere. When the Honourable Member has a slightly better, broader, and deeper understanding of the health service, about which he watches and notices at the moment, he will understand that it is a nonsense to call for a guarantee that no operation will be cancelled due to bed shortage and pray. Yeah, this is, Mr. Speaker, the sort of answers we used to get in the House. In respect of questions 655 and 656, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to the answer provided to question, written questions 128 of this year. Mr. Speaker, up until the 30th of September 2017, 5 complaints have been made to the Ombudsman concerning the decision taken by the Board. Mr. Speaker, if the referring consultant disagrees with the TRB's decision, they may resubmit the referral with any additional information that the consultant feels is relevant and would assist the Board in this deliberation. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to answers provided in questions numbers 646 and 647 in respect of answer to question 652. In relation to the footnote, this is a standard inclusion in any referral letter and relates to the guarantee that any medical cost associated with the referral will be met by the GHA. This is purely for accounting purposes and is in no way a consideration of the CRB. All referrals are proceed process irrespective of cost, and the footnote that is in all the referral letters have been there since time immemorial.
With reference to 655 and 656, 650, the government is referring me to written question 128. However, in 128, the answer given, written answer, question 158 of 2017, the answer is that the GHA was not agreeing the United States to respond to the reasonable promotion of confidentiality. However, I would like to refer the Minister to question 365 of 2016, which is June last year, where the Ministry undertook an enormous task under the former Health Minister
and actually brought up to date by 2015. So given that we have the figures and the entities and the hospitals in the amount paid, would it not be appropriate unless it's been a change of policy by the minister to provide an answer to this question?
I have no different figures. I don't provide you the totality of the amount for the taxpayer spend to the consensus. We are currently in a very active process of negotiations with different types of incentives where we think that we can get more funds for our buck in terms of different surgical, medical, and clinical procedures. Even what you identify, each type of incentive, with the amount that is provided, that may provide them with something as to what they were paid by the centre. And therefore, it would be a huge asset in the foot if they were to provide detail of the testing centre and the amount being paid.
Will the minister make an announcement when that process is completed?
With absolute pleasure.
And one more supplementary, Mr. Speaker. And I do hope that this is a sort of isolated case, although I do have two or three. And obviously, when the tertiary board has been convened and started, I think that there might be a transition period where people are not receiving the appropriate care. And there's a certain a particular case which I've listened to the Honourable Minister about in his life, but there's been further developments on that. And basically, what I have and what has been given to me is a letter from the 19th of September this year from the UK Consulting Surgeon to St. Dominic's Hospital. And I quote Mr. Speaker, says, I am writing regarding the above patient, whom I do not believe I have had any correspondence from you about. He is in the early stages of his follow-up, and we are still managing his survivorship issues. He had an appointment for this last week, which was he did not appear, because his ticket was not reported locally. This is all rather confusing, and I am sure you can appreciate that I would be grateful for some clarification from you so you can best support this patient during this ongoing treatment. And then the hospital, St. Bernard Hospital, has written to the nuclear consultant, and this patient has a prostate carcinoma. And in English, it actually asked the nuclear consultant, we would be grateful if you could provide us with your expert opinion on this case. So obviously this person is somewhat confused and stressed and obviously ill, and in the meantime is not receiving the care because he has still not been seen locally for his condition. And at the same time, he knows that he will have to undergo a further operation next year, which is what the UK consulting surgeon was put in. And it's not being approved, and he's not having to follow up by the surgeon who operated on the first occasion and should be the one who could operate on the second, having had already gone and intervened.
I think this to the Honourable Gentleman, and he can take the advice if he likes it or not, but given that he knows that he can write to me at any time and that I always reply to him, I'm just going to read from a statement or a letter. The least you could do, instead of a courtesy, not for effort, is to send me the letter before, so I can take it to my professional. But having said that, I can assure the Honourable Gentleman that I am okay with this particular case, and I'm extremely low and concerned about talking about any particular case across the floor of the house, because given remarks made by a relative of this particular person, it's already in the public sphere. So anything that I say will necessarily cast a light on what we may think within the GAA are the actions of this particular couple. And therefore, I would rather take any electoral criticism that comes to me from the public than to start telling me what I think about any particular case. Let me tell you, however, that given that there have been 550 cases considered by the TRB, and that 456 have been approved, and when not approved, there have been 51 cases offered alternative treatment, I think the percentage is 80% approved and 20% not approved. There have been 5 complaints to the ombudsman, and I've met them by incorporating 2 or 3 of the persons who have complained. It is inevitable that when there is a changing process and with my proper conclusions to speak on the GA state, there will unavoidably be an adjustment period and it will be great with some patients. I have told the Honourable Lady in the last session, I fully understand entirely when somebody who is comfortable with any particular hospital, for example, the hospital that the Honourable Mr. Keaton refers to, which is the Pamplona Hospital, where Libertarians seem to have an incredible amount of faith in this particular institution, and that when we take them, we can provide you with exactly the same treatment at home, and our clinicians, and all the research indicates that persons, etc., that live with cancer fairly do not travel, and therefore we ask you that we please give us the ability to manage your care. I understand fully that some people do not want to be treated here because they've been treated elsewhere. But I think that, as I told the Honourable Lady on the last occasion, it is a process of give and take between the GHA and these patients. As a result, the TRB has invariably, in other words, in every single case, allowed for a period of adjustment, allowing the couple or the patient to go to two or three more consultations outside of Gibraltar, even though we can provide the treatment here, in order to ensure two things. One, that is a proper handover, and two, not to provide any stress to the patient. But look, as I tell the Honourable Lady, I fully understand the concern and the anxiety that will be caused by saying the treatment will be stopped in the UK and Spain, and we're going to be providing it here. But the reason why we're providing it here is for clinical and medical reasons, and because we are convinced that it's best to treat people at home if we can provide the treatment.
Just one final supplementary addition to speak of. Will the Minister agree to consider this case behind the Speaker's chair, where he may be able to go back to his advisors and review this case, given the evidence which obviously they've given in to my attention?
Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman, again, he knows that I'm capable and knows that I'm fine. If he wants to do any particular case to my attention, he'll speak to me. So, but I think I need to make an important point. I'm not a doctor, I'm not a surgeon, and even though some people think that by becoming municipal health, I have acquired the status of being a surgeon, and I'm asked about different procedures. If I have seven professionals telling me that a particular course of action is clinically indicated, I cannot argue clinically. However, let me give this offering to the Honourable Gentleman. If a clinical indication is that a person should be treated locally, but there are wider considerations of compassion, of humanity, that require the person to be seen one or two more times by the tertiary centre, then the tertiary board is very good to ask me. And of course, it's a matter, it's a policy decision for us, which we can take.
Mr. Speaker, a number of supplementaries for me. Just in relation to the exchanges that occurred a few moments ago between my honourable friend and the Minister, in relation to the breakdown of costs for foreign establishments. In June of last year, my question, I think the Honourable Gentleman, it wasn't the Honourable Gentleman, it was in fact his colleague, Minister for Affairs, provided the cost in quite a detailed schedule relating to Zani Hospital in particular. And I was actually surprised when last month I asked a similar question, and as has been pointed out, the answer was that for commercial reasons, the government was not in a position to reveal how much was being paid to hospitals. Now, when will the exercise be complete so that those figures will be provided to this Parliament? Absolutely being pursued, and the Honourable Gentleman should, I think, know that the sooner that I can get to the end of the process, the better. Because I think that we can, as I said, the Honourable Mr. Yannis is saying, better value for money. So it is something that I am actively pursuing. Only yesterday, I had a further meeting with my financial advisors, and we're quite close to being able to proceed. But we will not be with only one tertiary centre, it will be with various.
So it would not be, as they say in the Spanish vernacular, fry an egg, it would take some time. But if I can't get into belly, I don't know that they will conclude. Just to say that it's possibly being pursued, and it may start to again in a couple of months' time, and maybe able to give them a more definitive thing.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to the first question that I asked, which is the question about the explanation in relation to increasing costs. Since 2012, just to put it in percentage terms, since 2012 to 2016, excluding this year, the cost of referrals to foreign hospitals or treatment in foreign hospitals and medical establishments has gone up by more than 400%. Now, does the government accept that what we are seeing, and I'm not criticizing it, I'm just asking as least the terms possible with questions, does the government accept that, that effectively during those 4 years, none of the factors that the Honourable Gentleman is outlined are sufficient to explain, either individually or collectively, an increase of over 400% in cost? And what we have seen over the last 4 years is perhaps an opening of the gap in relation to, this area, and the government is now effectively trying to roll back on some of that expenditure that we have seen increase by 400% over the last 4 years. Mr. Speaker, I think in the first place to say that it's important that the retailers have the best and most varied access to testing centers, both in the UK and in Spain. I came in as a health minister, I suppose, with a fresh pair of eyes, and perhaps looking at the cost of certain things from our more commercial perspective, and asking the question of whether certain surgical medical things procedures also cost the government as much to do. And inevitably, the results came back that perhaps we were not obtaining the best value for money in respect of funds and procedures. That's why I told both gentlemen, honourable gentlemen, that there is an active review process in place. I would ask them to, for the sake of the vote, not to press them anymore, because these discussions are live, and we do not want to prejudice what we hope will be obtaining a better commercial deal for Gibraltar that provides exactly the same number and variety of treatments, maybe even more, but the prices that we are being advised would be far more reflective of what other institutions pay to private institutions than what we currently pay. But I think the point that I make the point that I think that the first priority for any government authority is to make sure that patients have the care that they need. And therefore, that's what's been happening. I'll come in later, once the system has been in place, I've been looking at it, I think with the benefit now of the system having been established.
I don't believe I'm supposed to answer to question 644, where I asked for the papers were broken down by psychic treatment investigation in that kind of detail. You know, he's just giving me an overall figure. Is he able or willing to give me that breakdown?
The only reason I have been the sense of exchanging is that I've just had a couple of calls on my feet. For some reasons, I'm not willing at this point to provide an additional judgment.
I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker, I think we may be across purposes. I'm referring to section 644, one thing that the cases referred to social referral and the broken down by type of treatment referred, whether they would be included in why in this case.
Speaker, I don't know what the Honourable Gentleman thinks is going to glean from breaking the figures even down. There's been 550 cases referred by a clinician, by a consultant, out of 550, one is a specific thing,
71 were not approved, and 51 were offered alternative pathways. And the criteria that explained in my answers today, in the last session of Parliament, and also in my budget speech, is that it is only not indicated when the procedure can be done in Gibraltar. So the only reason why a referral will not be made is either because it's not clinically indicated, or because the procedure can well be provided in Gibraltar. So you can be provided on this, then the person will not be referred to the UK as the same.
Non-wisely as to the proper treatment investigation for the authorities. Is he willing to give it back, or is it just a blanket no?
Mr. Speaker, even if I was to tell you right now everything in investigation I would consider, it wouldn't matter. What I'm telling the Honourable Gentleman is that if a consultant refers to a matter to the Tertiary Referral Board, and that clinical, medical, or surgical procedure can be done in Gibraltar, then the person for a board will, unless there are reasons why the person should go to the UKSA, be dealt with either medically, surgically, or clinically in Gibraltar. So the only reason why a referral will not happen is because the care can be provided locally.
I've heard one sign the Minister is saying, but again, he's not answering my original question. Broken down by type of treatment or investigation. Is he willing or is he not willing to provide information?
I've already told you that it's irrelevant to the question that he's asking.
If you see this as a point of order, it's really up to me to determine what is relevant to my question.
I am not in a position to give a ruling in this matter. As an honourable member, you must understand that is. 15 or 20 questions are being taken together. I find it extremely difficult to keep track on what to say to what. Now, I can see that question 644 from the overall answer that the Minister made does not appear to have been answered specifically. In the sense that he hasn't given a breakdown. I don't see a breakdown here in respect of type of treatment. Now, I don't think that it is irrelevant to ask that. Maybe the Minister is in no position to answer that type of question. I think that he shouldn't, because there are certain reasons why dangers, I suppose, or some patients could be identified. I don't know, I'm not sure. He may have good reasons as to why he hasn't answered it, but I am not in a position to make any ruling on this.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the whole thrust of all the questions I've received in the TRB is why the TRB makes one decision and not another.
And the thrust of everything I've told you on the gentleman is that a referral will take place if the care is not provided locally. Now, there have been 550 cases. In order to ask the TRB to start going through every single file and providing every single surgical, medical, and clinical reason, that will take away from the 7 clinicians who are all senior clinicians and are either operating or telecommissioning from duty to provide the information. And in some cases, it will also be publicly known by the information that is being provided. But the reason why I haven't provided that granularity of detail is only the procedure, which is the way the commissioners have opened the job. If they really want it, I will ask the team to do so in slow time, and then it will take so long as it takes. But what I'm trying to tell the other gentleman, without being able to see the difficulty, is that irrespective of what the procedure is, the answer will not change.
Mr. Speaker, I'm going to stand ready to your answer. There's a fuller answer to my question than I would have expected. And if I may, by way of explanation, so the reason I asked this is I wanted to get a feel for what are the types of cases that will be referred, or things like cancer related, heart related, surgical, some kind of general feel for what it is that the profile is of the referral. And that is really what the thrust of my question is for that. it is either 90% of the referrals are cancer-related or 90% of the cases are cardiac-related. And just to get a general idea as to where the workload is in terms of surgery referrals. And then that in itself will later on perhaps set off other questions in terms of, okay, we have 90% of cancer, how are they being addressed in terms of selecting hospitals? That's where I'm coming from. But, you know, so I understand what the minister said in the first instance, but I would be grateful that sometimes in the future, I'm sure the surgery referral board must keep a record of why it is that, or what cases were coming before them. I'm sure they have an agenda. And it's just putting more specific keeping, which I'm sure they must do with some of them.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, but this is, I think the Honourable Gentleman alludes on this point, but for a different reason than I'm telling. Yes, of course they can find the relevant cases, and this is the point. If they were to go to the 550 cases, they wouldn't just have received information that said cardiology, neurology, oncology. They would actually have specified the kind of treatment, the kind of surgical intervention. In other words, it would have been a huge task. If what he wanted to ask me were the general lines of medical inquiry, oncology, neurology, cardiology, then of course that would be easily provided to him, Mr. Speaker.
I'd be satisfied with that kind of data without having to go too granular in being able to provide that to the house. I'd be very, very grateful. And Mr. Speaker, what I'm for, and I think, coming back to the general thrust of the question, the questions I've asked the minister are not because I have any particular curiosity myself, but these are questions driven from meetings with constituents who are expressing concern about the non-referral rate. And I would ask the minister, when he mentioned a change of process and that this social referral board came into being on the 4th of May 2017, the first question I had is why was there a change of process compared to happening previously? And what was it that happened previously? And do you think it's right that seven consultants or possibly appointees by medical director should second guess a consultant? I mean, Mr. Speaker, I will read here extract from the letter of consultation with a responsible consultant named the social referral board met on Saturday. Your consultant referred you to another hospital for further medical treatment and or investigation. A letter referral presented to the board for consideration. The board has not, in bold letters, approved this referral. This decision has been reached by board of senior clinicians for considered information provided in the referral letter. After reviewing the case, the board has determined that this referral does not provide the optimum treatment for your condition, as well as consultants to review the treatment plan in partnership with you. We have organized an appointment for you to see a consultant in clinic as soon as possible in order to explain to you what the new treatment investigation plan will be. You will be contacted with the details of this appointment in the next few days. The consultant may request that the board reconsider the referral by updating the board any further relevant clinical information. Finally, I wish to assure you the whereas this may not be the decision you wish to receive. The board is careful to submit to your very best interest at heart. Now, Mr. Speaker, my question to the minister is, a patient who receives a letter who may be suffering from chronic medical condition, we're not asking for a Disney cruise, they're asking for medical treatment. And it's really them that's asking for medical treatment, they're consulting. So, I'm saying that the GHA consultants don't know what they're doing, and I have to go to another group of consultants with them saying, no, you got this wrong, go back and try again. But in this process, the patient is the one who seems to be none the wiser. Surely there must be a process whereby the consultant might at least have a peer-to-peer discussion before making a referral letter, or is it that the consultant doesn't know what he's doing, and so he needs better consultants? Well, something that doesn't quite work in my mind, and certainly, yes, in the UK, I beg your pardon? Yeah. In the UK, certainly in hospitals, yes, there is a referral panel, but that tends to be at the GP level before they get referred to consultants. But once it gets to the consultant level, Mr. Speaker, the consultant is the one that can determine the treatment. What we have here, it would appear, is consultants determining the treatment and then being overruled by another set of consultants. Surely, there must be a way to overcome this kind of problem. I come back to my question is, why has the process changed? And in terms of the interest of the patient, that's ultimately what we all care about, surely we can come up with a better process whereby patients are not subjected to these level of threat. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, I think that the Honourable Gentleman has become the greatest political figure of China since Cinderella. And I know that he wants to be the new a leader of the opposition and therefore making political speeches.
I'm trying to be liberal and allow honourable members to have extended on matters which are of great importance, particularly to people concerned, to those who are ultimately sponsored patients. I have allowed the leader of the opposition to make a question lasting nearly 5 minutes. You all know what the rules say, don't you? And so we are debating, really, that is what is happening. So unless the Honourable Minister can answer also more succinctly, I suggest that we carry on and that either the government or the opposition make it their business to table a motion when you can have a proper debate on the issue.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman in answer to the Minister's 5 minute question did present a whole series of inherent contradictions, which I will not address at the moment, Mr. Speaker. But the point of this must be, I think, learned this. If there were no quality concerns in the GHA, and if money was being spent on the money, they would come to the house to accuse us of us spending money without consequences.
This is not at all unusual for one set of professionals in quality assure the work of another. If you go to any law firm or any other professional firm, you have a firm of accountants and auditors. They come in, they check the work that's being done, and the quality is sure. A consultant will refer the matter to the testing and failing board. This is one consultant. And therefore, the board will consider whether the referral is indicated at any particular moment. The consultant may well have, without having to question the intelligence of the consultant or whether he knows whether he's doing or not, and all the disrespect that entails, is that you may have been unaware that because of the pace at which the repatriating services currently, that particular treatment is currently being provided by the DHA, and that therefore the referral is unnecessary. But Speaker, the TRB, in my estimation, has done an excellent job. There have been 550 cases only since May. Only 20% have been refused, and of that, alternative pathways have been referred. And therefore, if the testing phase board are there to ensure that the care of the patient is best provided, and they're providing advice to the consultant of how best to achieve that, what does that mean? On the basis that 80% of all referrals are being approved and patients are going to either Spain or the UK to receive their treatment. Quality assurance, Mr. Speaker, and quality concerns are actually a very good thing.
No, Mr. Speaker, I agree with the Honourable Gentleman that any system of a public expenditure needs quality controls. Otherwise, you end up in a situation where the taxpayer, at the end of the day, everybody, including those who are being treated in hospitals, ends up overpaying. But you see, the problem here is, and I return to the initial exchange with you, which have been placed, that the only little I have, which have been placed in sharper focus, some of those exchanges by the exchanges now with the Honourable Leader of the Opposition. In 2012, we were spending 3.6 million. 2012. By 2016, it goes up to 15.4 million, over 400%. This year, in October up to now, it's 4 million.
with 1 million in the pipeline. I would expect probably on those kind of projections that it's probably going to come in at about 6-7 million at the most. That's half of what it was in 2016, and therefore, are we seeing a reaction to overexpenditure in the past and the turning on of that tap? I'm hesitant because it takes me to be personally, and I wouldn't want to offend it. But a reaction to that turning of the tap onto the on position when the Honourable Gentleman gave one hint, but at the end of the day, we're talking about public funds. Has stewardship over his ministry.
Mr. Speaker, I wish that his estimate of expenditure were correct, but I think I'm afraid he's going to be up there around 7 million, I think. So there's not going to be a precipitous decline in expenditure from 1 year to another. I wish you were right. I did say this during the course of the budget speech. I kept informing that it was a very long budget speech, that we have been incorporating services to the GHL, as indeed my honourable colleague did with oncology. And oncology is one of those services where we've advocated that people felt, I think, understandably very attached to the particular institution in the Spain or the UK. So, repatriation of services will mean that there are less costs for escorts, less cost in patients, less cost in terms of transport travel, although of course, very unfortunately, as a result of the unexpected collapse of Lennox Airlines, prices at the end of the high point rail have shot up. So what used to cost maybe only £30 now may cost £1,000. So unfortunately, it's definitely going to be even way off because of that. So now, Mr. Speaker, what the Honourable Gentleman is, what you think is simply a consideration of the contract and plans we have with our private providers, just to see that we get value for money. I've already said that we're actively engaged in that process, and also that as we increase the number of services being provided in the border, even if we have to increase the consultants to provide that service, it's going to be infinitely cheaper than the millions that we spend on transport and escort places, etc. So that is why, if hopefully we come down on fossil-related costs, it is only because we're providing more services locally.
Mr. Speaker, one final question. I don't know whether the Honourable Gentleman has the information in front of him. I suspect that I know the answer, but are the ones that are being rejected, are they referrals to the United Kingdom rather than Spain? Because I think the logic of what the Honourable Gentleman is basically saying in terms of travel costs, etc., probably more applicable to the United Kingdom and elsewhere rather than Spain. And I ask the question because what we have seen, in fact, if the Honourable Gentleman looked at the answer that he gave me to question 126, which is a breakdown of all the all the medical establishments and hospitals where people are being treated. In fact, the numbers are static from 2015 to 2016, except for Zayed Hospital, where there's an increase in 2015 from 90 to an increase of 140 in 2016. I just wonder whether there is a conscious policy of basically carrying many of these patients towards Zayed Hospital, cut the number of costs in terms of travel, etc., rather than in the United Kingdom. Maybe I've got to be telling you. The short answer is they do not have the information of to what centres the Cases Going Board has not approved, although I suspect that it would be both for Spain and the UK because it wouldn't make any difference whatever on
whether somebody is referred. All that matters is whether the referral is clinically indicated, in other words, the person requires the medical, surgical, or clinical treatment, and whether it can be provided in the UK, Spain, or Gibraltar. If it can be provided in Gibraltar, then it will be provided in Gibraltar.
So the appointment with the speaker, when we are running for example, you have to refer to the quality control and so on.
Now you have to be yourself. Is he aware of an executive board to look into
that the quality of the communication between the local medical services and the patient of the patient are top quality? The main concern coming from all the patients is the delay in the intake system are able to go. If I can give you one very big example, a patient goes away from the ball set, is seen to, and a consultant says, I want to see you back in 6 months' time, when there's only 1 month left for that patient to go. And they turn up a consultation. Only then are they told via a very casual and public conversation over the counter, I can bear it, oh, no, you're not going, you've got to be referred to the board. It comes to the sector system. That patient will be back to work in 5 months, and there seems to have been no follow-up. There seems, and there's been nothing. At least the patient is not resting assured that the best quality treatment has been given to him. Is the minister aware of that, or can he undertake to look into it?
Mr. Speaker, we've already had this exchange across the floor. Obviously, we're not into everything here. I've explained now at least 3 or 4 times that the Italian hospital, instead of writing to the GHA, write directly to the patient. So it's not that the GHA decides in an unseemly, public, inarticulate way to tell them when they're at. It's just that we don't know. And as a maxim of great GHA staff, they're not mind readers. And therefore, unless the patient who receives the letter from the UK or Spanish Testing Centre tells us the moment they receive it, we don't know. It's this way. I've already had this discussion with other members of the position before. So, believe me, Mr. Speaker, if things were done differently, which is what the testing referral board finally now is achieving, and you have a lighting on it, but against in a different way, is that there is a communication between the GHA and the referral centre. And therefore, all communications are between us, as opposed to what used to happen before, only with some centres, that once the referral was made by the GHA, they would write directly to the patient, thereby completely bypassing the GHA. That's it, Mr. Speaker. I want to assure the Honourable Gentleman and anyone who has been listening to this debate now for the fourth or fifth time that if they receive a letter directly from any referral, from any centre from outside of the of Gibraltar, they need to please tell us immediately so we can get copy.
I will be very, very brief. I'm glad that the minister didn't indicate to the House whether the creation of the Social Referral Board was an idea that came from the medical director or was it written?
Neither, Mr. Speaker.
Question number 634, the Honourable Arne Kempton.
Mr. Speaker, how many service users in the streets and the streets of artificial limbs at the 31st of August 2017 are controlled in and for which limbs?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 635, 659, 651, and 657.
635, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure the members of the public would be likely to hear the Chief Minister's joke. Mr. Speaker, who in the GHA is in charge of and qualified
to attend to patients of opposition limits.
636, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, from where does the government of GHA support artificial limbs?
Question number 637, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, with which medical authority specialised in artificial limbs does the government of GHA work in respect to orthopaedic fitters, prosthetic fitters, and specialised physiotherapists?
Question number 638, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise how many serious users are being provided with artificial limbs as at 31st of August 2017, and of those, how many are expected congenital deficiency, and how many amputees, and for which limbs?
Question number 639, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, what is the government and GHA's policy in respect to the provision of artificial limbs and their maintenance?
Question number 651, the Honourable Ellis Yaman.
Mr. Speaker, can the government explain why the amputee service has been discontinued locally, and what is the procedure for services structured for service moving forward?
Question number 657, the Honourable Ellis Yaman.
How much did the running of the entity clinic cost the taxpayer spending per year since April 2012 to date, and how many service users access the service per payment per year?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid that I am unaware of what is meant by the term service fee. Mr. Speaker, the clinical management of patients with artificial limbs is conducted via a qualified multidisciplinary team and coordinated by the GHA Physiotherapy Department. The GHA clinicians, actors, specialists or social services and supervisors, namely Edcare Limited in the UK and Clinica in Slovenia, Boyacos and Malaga. Artificial limbs are sourced from the latter. Mr. Speaker, as of the 31st of August, 16 patients have been provided with prosthetics, all of which were in respect of lower limbs. There are no patients currently accessing GHA prosthetic services as a result of congenital limb malformation. Mr. Speaker, following amputation and a recommendation from the relevant multidisciplinary team assessment, all patients requiring a prosthetic limb are provided with a suitable prosthesis by a qualified orthotic team. A prosthesis, all prostheses, are regularly reviewed and maintained. Mr. Speaker, the regular amputee clinic was discontinued locally due to the professional qualifications of the prosthetic services offered by prosthetic clinicians in Spain not being compatible with the qualifications recognised by the Medical Registration Board of the GHA, namely Healthcare and Professional Council Registration. Edcare UK currently provides two clinical sessions per year in Gibraltar. And since we fall to health, apparently there are no patients waiting for prosthetic limbs. Mr. Speaker, the annual cost in relation to the running of the amputees clinic is in the schedule and I hand over to the Honourable Gentleman. These costs include all orthotic services, including the provision of prosthetic limbs, information is commercially sensitive and should be kept confidential.
So one supplementary with regards to the amputee clinic. I understand the reason now for discontinuing the clinic. However, I am told that in servicing the artificial limbs, amputees have to travel to Malaga at the moment to undergo reviews and obviously this presents challenges to them. other than obviously having to leave the day as they will be working again. Is this something that the government is thinking and is frustrated about to be voted?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, absolutely. In the first place, as I said, in Oxfam UK Council provide 2 things for 7 per year to vote, but we have no second looking at the consultation of the services.
Question number 648, the Honourable Ellis Young.
Mr. Speaker, does the government by way of policy refer all new cardiac patients to the cardiac rehabilitation unit?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the term cardiac patient is very broad. Not all patients with cardiac. Oh, sorry, yes. Mr. Speaker, the last question together with question 649, my apologies.
Question number 649. The Honourable Ellis Young.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide details of how many persons are on the cardiac rehabilitation waiting list, and if so, when they have been on the waiting list?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the term cardiac patient is broad. Not all patients with cardiac disease have indications or are appropriate for cardiac rehabilitation. Therefore, in answer to the question, it is not the policy of the DHHM for all cardiac patients. The plan is to refer those patients who both have an indication for and are assessed as appropriate to receive cardiac rehabilitation. This can happen either way at the point of discharge from hospital by a consultant cardiologist at clinical review or by the patient's GP. Patient enrollment in the cardiac rehabilitation program is prioritized clinically. They therefore may be fined waiting time for entry into the cardiac rehabilitation program.
There may be a in cardiac care. And again, you know, I asked a simple question the Minister may or may not have information to hand. But what is the head count of the cardiac rehabilitation unit? Well, how many staff is involved?
Excuse me, I'm afraid I don't have that information with me. I have to ask you.
Can I take it down, and I would like to confirm with the Minister that there are no people waiting to join the rehabilitation programme?
Mr. Speaker, there are 8 patients on the way through.
Question number 652, the Honourable Ellis Young.
Mr. Speaker, is the government confident that all Alzheimer and dementia residents in the elderly care agency receive the same level of care and have access to the same amenities?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the elderly residential service consists of different long-term care units, which are currently mentioned earlier, still managed the same. Shelter and Cochrane Ward in St. Bernard's Hospital on Hillsides, which cases the treated and for dementia patients. Dementia is definitely prevalent in our elderly residential population, and therefore all these units are patients with varying degrees of dementia. Each DRS unit has its own set of facilities and amenities and is run by qualified staff nurses with specialist knowledge in dementia. All units provide the same ratio of staff to residents. All the units have regular input with specialist doctors and consultant supervision among elderly care specialists. All units have access to activity programs and equipment for dementia patients.
However, depending on the particular unit, there are different levels of dementia support available and activities available. Other facilities, garden terrace and patio, are available in all the units and the use of which is only limited depending on patient safety. Is the ideal residential service hospital opinion team considers that a patient needs a best suited for a different unit, there are mechanisms for transferring patients in between units.
Does the minister see that there being appropriate to have to or even consider that moving forward it might be wise to consolidate these residents and provide a second and specialized units within FICO or if you get all the residents who are spotted out around the elderly care agency and bring them all together and make sure that there is the same sort of level of amenities and things as offered in the hospital, which is obviously the proper range at the moment. Is that something that the government would consider moving forward?
Mr. Speaker, divorce is blessed with many, many, many things. Land is unfortunately not one of them, so I don't think we'll be able to find a plot of land or a building big enough to be able to centralise all the different dramatic ways home. Mancavania, Hillside, and the different wards in which are situated in St. Benedict's in 1811. If I may, I think that the only government what is trying to get at is whether I am satisfied that the amenities in the different places are to the standard of Hillside. Now, Hillside is, as you correctly said, a top-notch home because it has just been rolled out, it has been built, and therefore, but in that respect, we do have a fund available and we are replacing furniture as furniture breaks in different parts of our elderly residential units. We are replacing them with furniture that is always dementia friendly. So even if the elderly person that goes to that elderly residential unit does not live with dementia, he or she will nonetheless have that state-of-the-art furniture because, unfortunately, as we live longer, sometimes persons who initially do not have dementia or have low levels of dementia may develop moderate to acute dementia. So it makes sense to ask that as a disease progresses, the elderly person is in a unit that has all the most recent amenities. Interestingly, he says to me that his price is top of the range. I would agree with him that it certainly is state of the art in terms of what a dementia home should be, but there have been cases in my experience where people do not want to go to Hillside. I want to go to Mancavania or want to go to other wards. So it does depend as well on the needs of the patients, sometimes initially, but also family members.
Question number 654, the Honourable Elephant.
Is the government still committed to a primary care clinic with dedicated GP resources exclusively for children, with a dedicated waiting area for children and the parents only?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, yes. The government is entirely committed to a primary care clinic with dedicated GPs for children. And we are planning, in that respect, Mr. Speaker, to revolutionise the care that we provide to children with dementia. The government, for the past 11 months, has been working closely with the medical director and the senior paediatric clinician in all departments to produce an integrated care of primary and secondary services to children in a family-friendly environment.
Question number 658, the Honourable Ella Fiamma.
Mr. Speaker, since December 2011, the government provides details of wards within the health and care system, which has the intelligent staff complement, including A, the date the complement change, B, former grade complement, C, post change grade complement, and D, wards.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, in answer to this question, it's important to note that the schedule that I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman was defined using a snapshot of staffing levels on one particular day, and statistics vary on a day-to-day basis, depending on annual needs, sickness, any other absenteeism, or redeployment of staff for operational reasons.
Question number 660, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Asanman.
Does government accept A&E staff assertions that low manning levels in the department is leading to poor quality of care and staff feeling burnt out?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and
Justice. Mr. Speaker, we'll answer this question together with questions 661, 662 and 664.
Question number 661, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan.
Can the Minister for Health state whether St. Bernard's Hospital currently has an in-house gynaecologist or in-house gynaecologist to cater for the standard gynaecological appointment?
Question number 662, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan.
Is government satisfied with the waiting times for ultrasound at St. Bernard Hospital?
Question number 664, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassanan.
Will the government be opening the hospice they committed to be working on delivering with cancer relief as per its 2015 manifesto?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I do not accept the premise of the Honourable Lady's question regarding alleged staff assertions, which I for one have not been made aware. I can confirm that the A&E department has been staffed over and above the minimum recommended requirements. In fact, additional staff have recently been assigned to the department on the 2nd of April of this year, which has seen an increase of 65 nurses from 1 to 3. Further, Mr. Speaker, an experienced senior consultant has been recruited and is due to commence employment as of the 13th of November in the department tasked with the overall management of A&E. As the Honourable Lady may be aware from Press Release 133, the A&E department has recently undergone a major expansion. The new area, fitted with the latest infection control procedures, includes 5 beds, a new nursing section with computer access and additional rooms and storage area. The department currently treats an average of 100 patients a day, which is a 10-year increase in comparison to the number of patients treated with the New St. Bernard Hospital in 2005, where an average of 50 to 60 patients a day were treated at A&E. This week, the GHM Council has a team of gynecologists for all general gynecological requirements in the community. The Speaker, the government is constantly striving to improve access to GHM services and minimize waiting times for all patients. Urgent ultrasound for inpatients continue to be performed within 24 hours. Urgent ultrasound for outpatients are usually performed within 3 weeks. Since March of this year, waiting times for ultrasound services were recently reduced from 19 weeks to an average of 12 weeks, a reduction of over a third in terms of waiting times. A radiographer has recently been tasked with conducting these services to assist in maintaining these reduced waiting times. Mr. Speaker, the government is in advanced stage of discussion with cancer relief trustees regarding the development of hospital services. I hope to soon be in a position to formally announce the next stage in the delivery of hospital care in Gibraltar in the new year.
I can take the supplementaries one by one on 660. Mr. Speaker, regarding the A&E staff assertions about low manning levels, I've heard these complaints from some members of staff themselves. And would the Minister continue to deny that these expressions are valid? Because, well, we don't want in a department like A&E is to have serious incidents arising out of these low mining levels. I appreciate the extensions as we have just shown, but I'm being told that at times there's only one ANE doctor on duty, and it's something that I believe is relatively low and even dangerous. Can you expand on this?
I do not want to answer with the Honourable Lady into the usual discussion that we've had about standing orders and as to whether we can comment on things that we hear from other people. I'm not going to answer into it, but you know, the Honourable Lady is keen and fond of hearing things and then coming to me to tell me about them. And I've already referred to her for the various standing order for this institution briefly. And I've already explained to her that if we were in the house to answer to every rumor, allegations, and assertion made by people in the street, we would not leave this house. And therefore, it is important, I think, that the late Honourable Lady Officer, if she can, not come to this house with what she hears, as opposed to trying to verify what it is that she has said, or at least ask me a different kind of way. I've read to her the answer, which is since. This year, there's been two additional staff nurses engaged. That means that we've gone from one to three. I've told her as well that we've engaged a senior consultant from the UK who has a ministry to do so to lead the A&E department to be able to perform a review. So, two additional staff nurses, which is the Honourable Lady knows, is the top tier nurse. Consultant at A&D, which I am told by the medical director, has not existed before, and therefore there has been an increase in the complement of A&D. Now, is it possible that on any particular day, one doctor at A&D has, because of fitness, not been in and has been a shortage of one doctor? That is entirely possible and plausible. But that does not mean that there is understaffing or that the complement is down. The complement is up, and therefore we are very gratified with that. And I think that having a consultant in the UK who has led an early department in a place which I think would be quite good crime in the UK, leading is important crime, which thankfully sees accidents and emergencies that are not of the type that you can fit in acute settings in the UK, would be a very good thing indeed.
So, Mr. Speaker, would the minister want to reassure the doctors that the way they feel is not valid or justified, or will he just leave it as is?
Mr. Speaker, I thought that he was talking with staff members, not because of their doctors. Right. I am in fluid discussion with the current head of A&E, Albert Kuchler, who I have to say, Mr. Speaker, is absolutely magnificent. He has no problem in telling me what he thinks at any time. And so I can assure the Honourable Lady that if there were to be anything to tell me, he would tell me, my apologies. But as I say, with the best will in the world, and even after we have the consultant A&E managing the department, and even if they were to increase the staff level from 1 to 5, there will inevitably be a day or two where there will be a huge rush of patients at A&E, and in that particular day, unfortunately, one doctor is in sick leave and others on that, and there's very little we can do to remedy that other than being told and calling somebody to come in. And as I understand it, every time there is such absence at A&E or CCU, or other wards in the same body hospital, they do call people to come in. Yeah. And Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister is referring to the 2011 manifesto where we said that we were committed to starting in scenario and that there was a need for an A&E consultant, which is a manifest commitment that has now been completed.
Mr. Speaker, regarding the question on the gynecological, the decision of the gynecologist, I have received various complaints. I'm actually a little bit confused as to what I am or what I'm not allowed to bring to this house, because I think that people's testimony that.
What the rules require is that every member should make himself or herself responsible for statements made in the house. So, you make yourself responsible for what you say, or for what you're told.
I do make myself responsible for what I'm told, so that's why I don't think there's any harm in bringing these testimonies to the House. Otherwise, I don't know where we can get information, because actually when I've tried to get information from government, I've even gone as far as receiving an email recently from the Chief Secretary saying that government workers aren't even allowed to speak to me, so I don't know where I'm supposed to...
What members, elected members are not supposed is to contact the Health Department, senior civil servants directly. If you want information, you either get it from the minister, or you may in certain circumstances write to the chief secretary to ask for information. But what you cannot do is to phone a civil servant or a top government employee, a manager, and ask for information behind the back of the minister. That is not allowed, and has never been.
Mr. Speaker, that's fair enough, but I'm bringing testimony from constituents and members of staff, and I'm also being told that, you know, again, it's either rumorology or I'm not allowed to bring them here, so I am a little bit confused as to what I'm entitled to talk about.
Mr. Speaker, if I can be of assistance around the way, I think the Speaker has made very clear what it is that the other way can do with public service. Public servants are not there to answer the Honourable Lady's political questions. But if she hears something on the street and she wants to bring it here, what the rules say is that she must be responsible for that. So if you bring something here which you hear on the street, and that is not a reliable place to hear things and to base political action on, because what we're saying is you're making yourself responsible for that. The person in the street says what they want. In other words, they say what might be said, having hearsay, and what may be one half of a story, because people in the street tend to pay attention really that half of the story which suits them. Usually what I would have thought would have been more appropriate, and it's the way that things have been handled hitherto. And I commend it not just to her, but to all honourable members. If you hear something, pick up the phone and call in. Someone will not be able to be on the phone immediately, but you will try and get back to the honourable members opposite as soon as possible. All right. I think I have heard this. It's a stupid practice. The other one we're going to reply, which is either justify what she has been told by telling her the other half of the story, or will give her the full picture. She might take the view that there's another issue to raise in the town, or indeed confirm a position. She's unable to come to the house with that full picture and say, look, I heard this, and the minister told me it's true, and he told me this for this reason. And I think that's wrong for this reason. And there may be a disagreement and a good reason for asking a question. There's nothing to stop the able lady to come to this house and put to us what is put to her on the street. But very often, that is just not going to lead to a debate, which is a question and answer, because we're not in debate, that is going to be edifying in any respect. It's just going to get us closer to reality, and we can get to reality much more quickly, and then she can come here and make a political point about that reality, rather than simply hear us say, well, that's what we may have been doing in the street. But there was never a consultant before at ONE. It was our policy that there should be a consultant in ONE. How can that now be not enough consultants at ONE? And get closer to the nub of it and then ask the political question if in another group.
I'm grateful for that explanation. Mr. Speaker, I just find it a little bit odd how it's always assumed that I'm bringing issues from the street, and that it's assumed that I'm not making myself responsible. I make myself responsible for everything I say. And to the credit of the Honourable Minister for Health, I do consult him a lot, and I do write to him with issues from constituents, and he is always very helpful, so I'm saying that openly. But that when I come with issues, I make myself responsible. I just want that to be known, that, you know, not to assume that they are from a street or a third hand. No, I didn't.
Order. I'm offering to order. Let's just make this sound. The Honourable Lady asked me, does government accept AME staff assessment, right? Standing Order 17.1.16 says a question shall not be asked as to whether statements of private individuals are accurate. Therefore, in my
humble estimation, Mr. Speaker, the question is simply out of order. But the question has been permitted, entirely, of course, after the Speaker's discussion, and I have answered it, Mr. Speaker. But the Honourable Lady, I think, should be saying, because not only do I reply to her emails immediately, I always try to resolve the issue immediately, but also I am told that it has never been the case before that officials have been members of the profession. And I have arranged for the Honourable Lady to be briefed by, because, you know, this is the sort of government that we are. We're open. You have questions, and if we're not persuading her, for whatever reason, I have actually arranged for her to meet with my official. So I think it's fair to say that the Honourable Lady can ask me whatever she likes about anything, about anything, and I will answer. But for the purposes of questions in this House, it's not appropriate to do so, Mr. Speaker.
If I can just thank you for it. If I can just pick up on the issue of the gynecologist, and I was told just now that there doesn't seem to be an issue with gynecologists, but I am making myself responsible for having been advised that there is a huge backlog and that there has been pressing issues with people who haven't been seen and have had to go away from the hospital because of the lack of gynecological medical doctors. So I would like to know if there is a plan in place to add any number of gynecologists, or and if this happens, will extra clinics be held in order to get rid of backlogs? Because I understand that there are quite a significant backlog and many women waiting to be seen.
I suggest that in that instance, what the Honourable Lady should do is to ask a question. You ask the Minister, is there a backlog in respect of appointments to see gynecologists? Instead of making a statement here in Parliament, for which you ask a question, you put the burden on the Minister to reply. Another question that then you can ask. What is the waiting time for patients to see gynecologists? That is your job. Your job is to ask questions during question time. Other than that, you bring a motion and we have a debate. But what we cannot have is a debate during question time based on what the Honourable Lady is being told by somebody, which today repeats here and makes herself responsible for that. Ask the question, you will get an answer from the Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I appreciate that, but from my information, the backlog is due to a patient being told that there are no gynecologists, which is why I bring up the question, are there gynecologists for standard appointments?
Answer to question 661, I imagine that this is what the Minister said. The DOJ currently has a team of gynecologists for all general gynecological requirements in the community. That's what the Minister has said. I imagine it's true.
The Honourable Lady's reference for 3.5 full-time equivalents, in other words, full-time persons and a part-time gynecologist, and by 2018 in the first quarter, there will be four full-time equivalents, gynecologists. There have always been three gynecologists in the DOJ since 2011.
Mr. Speaker, just on that, may I draw the Honourable Gentleman's attention to a question that I asked last month at 124 of 2017, where I asked for waiting times for referrals from the primary care centre to the hospital. And there, the Honourable Gentleman gave me an answer. The average waiting time for gynaecology is 16 to 20 weeks, which is, in fact, more than all the others. And all the others are, for example, general physician, 6 to 8 weeks, orthopedic, 8 to 20 weeks, ear and nose, 5 to 10 weeks. Pediatrician, 8 to 12 weeks, but for gynecology, it's 16 to 20 weeks. So it does appear
that at least in relation to this particular issue, that perhaps some of the things that the Honourable Lady may be hearing with problems getting appointments may be reflected, in fact, in the figures. And how can you explain, in the light of the answer about the resources in this particular department, to why the waiting times for gynecology are more than all the others?
Speaker, I think that in the same answer I told him that all urgencies are continue to be within 2 weeks. And therefore, if there is a diagnosis that requires urgency and emergency, the referral is done within 2 weeks. And it's all about routine referral. I've also told the Honourable Gentleman that whether it's 2011 or 3 gynecologists, and either a 3.5 full time equivalent, I've also told the House that as a result of the fact that I'm not looking, with the amount of time stipulated there, because as you rightly point out, there has been a continuing reduction trend in all specialties where we're recruiting another gynecological consultant to provide resilience to that list.
I think that may be careful with me if I've got something wrong, because there are many questions related to that. Am I right, did I hear correctly, the Minister said that in respect of the ME department, there was provision for 3 sisters. Is that correct? And is that correct for the minimum concern that the 3 posts are trying to be filled in, or are they waiting?
Speaker, it would be extremely mischievous and misleading of me to say that what these staff nurses at IMD, but in fact they're vacant, of course they're not working.
There were these 3 sisters, Mr. Speaker.
All right, so because of that, the ultimate origin, 3 charge nurses.
Mr. Speaker, I have an email here from a patient who even has to discharge herself from hospital because there was no gynecologist on top of him. He had 2 major cysts, 13 centimeters on his side, and ended up in Spain for treatment. So I don't know how the minister can tell me that there is no issue in terms of the complement of gynecologists, and I'm happy to pass on this email because the patient wants him to have it anyway.
Mr. Speaker, only the other day, the Honourable Lady sent me an email. She writes to me to say, this is happening. I see the email, I talk to the principal secretary, problem solved. If there's an issue with this patient, he can tell me, and I will look into it, but I cannot possibly comment on individual cases across the floor of the house.
Taking some the advantage of somebody who I could have asked the minister for help at the time. I didn't know at the time. This has come to me after I put the question.
Very well, ask me now, across the floor of the house, Mr. Speaker, it's just greatly unfair. I assist the Honourable Lady with everything to do, with everything. And she's supposed to embarrass me across the floor of the house, but look at me.
Really?
We're going to move on.
In an effort to ensure that we don't have this sort of spectacle again, if somebody already in hospital, the observation is referred to somebody who is an inpatient in the hospital with an existing medical problem, I've seen it not today because the person is obviously on Wi-Fi unable to send her material.
Honourable members are going to sit down. I'm getting a bit fed up, tired, the way in which the rules are being transgressed now. Really. I said that is the end of that. We are moving on to the next question. And let honourable members take on board the reason why I'm doing this. I don't want to have a repeat of this kind of spectacle again. It's not right for me to do so. Doesn't the Honourable the Chief Minister agree?
Mr. Speaker,
you need to add more to what I'm saying?
Mr. Speaker, I'd be grateful if you indicated which of the rules I am transgressing. Given that you've asked me to sit down.
But is there any need for you to say anything else?
Mr. Speaker, I am trying to assist the House to ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again, so that the Honourable Lady understands that if she has a live complaint from a patient, there are ways of dealing with that, which is not to put to the Honourable Minister, that the things in the set cannot be true because there is one case where somebody has a gynecological problem that is not negotiated. We would want, for the purposes of this community, to ensure that if there has been such an issue, we understand why it arose. Because if we have more gynecologists than we have ever had before, and we think that we're able to refer people who need urgent emergency treatment more quickly than before, which is what the honourable member has told, there will be sufficient on this case in respect of urgent referrals which are being done within 2 weeks. How can there be an instance, if that is true, that the honourable lady has referred us to in the course of that email? Now, this is what I said to her earlier. Very often, we only get half of the truth from a constituent. The truth as that constituent sees it. It may be that there is another half of the truth, or maybe that the constituent is absolutely and completely right. Because medicine is not an exact science, and sometimes we find that we are not able to provide the care that we might like to see service. But it is not something that we are able to resolve across the floor of this house. Because this house, at question time, is not the tertiary referrals board. It's not the board that is looking at the care of the individual in question. But we must be able to deal with it.
Mr. Prince is perfectly right. And just what I'm saying, let's move on to the next question.
Question number 663, the Honourable Ms. Cindy Hassan-Lam.
How government got plans to, like it did with the Bella Vista Daycare Centre, implement a zebra crossing by the Hillside Residential Centre as well?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and
Justice. Mr. Speaker, the government does have plans to implement a zebra crossing at Hillside, as it did at the Bella Vista Day Centre. Senior officials from the relevant departments have been raising these past months, and proposals are being presented to the Traffic Commission for consideration. The move of the House is now adjourned to Monday the 6th of November at 2:30 in the afternoon.
The House will now adjourn to Monday the 6th of November at 2:30 in the afternoon.